Hello and welcome to Value Driven Data Science, brought to you by Genevieve Hayes Consulting. I'm your host, Dr. Genevieve Hayes, and today I'm joined by guest Dr. Fei Huang to talk about fairness and anti-discrimination in machine learning. Dr. Fei Huang is a senior lecturer in the School of Risk and Actuarial Studies at the University of New South Wales and has won awards for both her teaching and her research. Her main research interest is predictive modelling and data analytics, and she's recently been focusing on insurance discrimination and pricing fairness. Fei, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much, Genevieve. It's definitely my, pleasure to join you, and I'm so happy to be here.
It's great to have you here. For our listeners, I first met Fei at the Actuary Summit earlier this year, where she presented a paper on fairness and anti-discrimination, which I'll include a link to in the show notes. And this is an excellent paper, and Fei actually won a prize for it, a well-deserved prize. There are a lot of interesting ideas in this paper, which I thought would be of interest to anyone working with data science and machine learning, not just in the insurance sector. And that's why I thought Fei would be a perfect guest for this podcast. So I'm extremely happy that Fei accepted my invitation to appear.
Thanks, Genevieve.
But before we get into the topic properly, how about we start with your background? So Fei, how did you first become interested in modelling fairness and anti-discrimination?
Yeah, that's a good question. Actually, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, I had some interesting conversations with Professor Jed Fritz, who is a professor in both Wisconsin Medicine and also Australian National University. Back then, we had some conversations on the importance of understanding the discrimination, fairness, and in particular, because we are both educators and we need to, educate future actuaries. And actually, part of the syllabus requirements in both the US and, UK, Australia, are around the regulations or understanding the regulations so that the actuaries know how to obey the rules and then do the right things when it comes to pricing, underwriting, and lots of insurance practice. So we both sort of, agree that this is a very important area. And also Jed was affiliated with, or has some, voluntary work in the Carroty Actual Society in the United States. So we sort of think it's a great idea to write a paper on discrimination. Actually, the very first motivation is from the education perspective. We saw that there's currently a gap about, what is insurance discrimination, what are the, social economic considerations there, and how can future actuaries understand this and also incorporate them in their business and pricing practice.
And everything that you've learned about discrimination with pricing, I'm sure it can be applied to a broader area,
Absolutely. Broader audience. Yeah.
So with fairness and discrimination, I mean, we all know what it means for a human to discriminate against another human. I mean, it's probably mm-hmm. happened. We've probably been on the receiving end of it for all of us. But the concept of a predictive model or an artificial intelligence discriminating against us as a person, that's a relatively new concept. I mean, it's like something out of a science fiction movie, with the Matrix, with the machines being the overlords of the humans and using us as batteries. So what does it mean for a model or an AI to discriminate against a person?
Yeah, I agree with you that, with the advent of AI and the big data, this topic is just getting more and more, attention from both regulators, practitioners, and also everybody. But I have to say that the concept itself is actually not new. I mean, even go back to that very olden ages, where, for example, when it comes to just like thinking about insurance pricing as example, even the insurers have very limited data sets to work with, and just several rating factors, there could also potentially be, you know, discrimination related issues. For example, there's some, you know, some example of redlining. I'm not sure if you heard of that. It's basically, say some banks or insurers or some, you know, financial services, they could, you know, write lines or, you know, circle out some geographic areas that they do not want to insure, right? So this sort of things actually also highly related to discrimination, because those geographic locations could be highly related to some race or some, you know, ethnicity related protected information. So this is actually not a new topic, but with the advent of AI and big data, it's just becoming more and more obvious, more and more important, because nowadays people can have access to lots of information and then also some opaque algorithm. So for example, in the olden days, you just do a regression or a very simple models, which is transparent, and then you know what is happening there. You can interpret the results. But nowadays, machine learning, artificial intelligence, that's actually just the means that some very complex models that people find it's very hard to explain. You know, explain the outcome or explain why it's generating this outcome. So that's just make the problem more complicated. And then with the added in impact of big data, right? So big data just means that you have more information, maybe social media information, maybe your personal habits or your banking details. So this sort of a great volume of consumers' data available, potentially available to financial services, then it could also mean that, you know, and plus the opaque algorithm, they all added together just make the problem more pressing and more important to address.
So what I'm hearing from you is, so because we've got more data and these black box models, mm-hmm. That's leading to discrimination, which might not have happened in the past when we had less data and more transparent models where people could see if the discrimination was actually occurring.
Yeah, it's just the more opportunities. So it's just that the say firms would have more opportunities. Sometimes they do not even know they are discriminating, because it's there could be, you know, indirect or proxy discriminations that it's basically not their intention, but it just happened, unfortunately, because of the black box models and the big data.
So how can that happen? How can you end up with a data scientist building a model that discriminates without them actually realizing they were doing it?
Yeah, the reason is that different data sets, they are associated. So when we say discrimination, it's usually related to some protected attributes that's specifically regulated in laws or the acts in different jurisdictions. For example, very commonly used protected attributes are, say, gender, race, disability. So this sort of things are protected information of people, but you know, the variables, the data sets, they are correlated with each other. And so when you collect a huge amount of data, for example, maybe females tend to purchase cars with smaller engines and the males tend to purchase cars with bigger engines, and just some simple examples. So even if you do not collect the gender, you say, I just collect the size of the engine, and when you use that for pricing, then you indirectly have disparate impact on the different genders. So, and then with a bigger data set, you know, there are all sorts of potential correlations and associations of those data sets with the protected attributes. Some of them you do not even know, because lots of the firms, they do not collect those information, do not collect your race or nationality or, you know, disability. So they do not collect. So they actually are not aware of that, but it's just that, you know, hidden there in the data sets.
One of the things I read about was that model that Amazon built to sort resumes in order to identify people who were most suited to a particular job. And initially they built the model and they found that it was discriminating against women, mm-hmm. Because historically Amazon, in their engineering type roles, had hired a lot of men, so there was a bias in favour of men. So they deliberately excluded gender from any of the data that went in, and it was not included as a rating factor in the model. But what they found was that the model then started to learn things that allowed it to discriminate against women. For example, it started identifying the universities in America that had a very high proportion of women and penalising people who went to those universities. And people who had participated in sports that were commonly participated in by women, they tended to get discriminated against. So it found all these proxies for someone being a woman and discriminated against them. And Amazon was unable to eliminate any discrimination against women. And ultimately, they completely shelved the model because they could not find a way to make it non-discriminatory.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I mean, this is a very good example of showing, you know, the power of the proxy information that could have on the impact of the protected information, say gender there. I think this sort of things are happening, you know, there are lots of applications related to this. Then it's related to the topic of direct discrimination and indirect discrimination. So if you do not use the information, say gender, in your data set, you simply avoid direct discrimination, but it's not guaranteed that you also avoid indirect discrimination. Actually, as long as the data set you have, say the universities or some other attributes that are related to the people, as long as they are related to gender, then it's basically, you know, it's almost guaranteed that, you know, your outcome would have impact on the genders, even if you do not use it. So then the problem would be, you know, how to mitigate. Yeah.
So how would you mitigate this?
Yeah, this is a very complex problem, I would say. Actually, it's also application specific and jurisdiction specific, line of business specific. So we must, you know, take them case by case. The reason is that actually the regulation on, you know, in terms of this indirect discrimination can be different for different line of business. For example, for some jurisdictions, let's say what we want to achieve is at the group level fairness. That means, say, on average, the females and the males, they should get the same opportunity, or they should have, you know, they should not have disparate, there should not be disparate impact affecting on the two groups on average. So this is a group level fairness. But for some other lines of business, people would, you know, want to achieve individual level fairness. That is, say, subject to their other attributes, or say, for example, is it insurance pricing, then it's subject to their risk levels or the risk-related rating factors. The males and the females should get the same prices for the same insurance product. So then that could be individual level fairness. And it's very complex. And I personally believe there are still some vagueness there in terms of regulation. It's still not crystal clear, especially for some line of business, what is a specific fairness that practitioners should incorporate in their practice.
So I'm trying to get my head around this whole individual versus group fairness. Mm-hmm. So I think I understand it in the insurance context, but I'm trying to apply that, think about how that would apply to other contexts.
Yeah.
So this is my thoughts about translating it into, say, the job recruitment example, like with Amazon, like we're talking about. So individual fairness would be two people, a man and a woman, who had identical resumes, except for one's a man and one's a woman. Mm-hmm. If it was individually fair, that would mean that those two people would be treated exactly the same. Is that correct?
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas group fairness would mean that those two individuals might not necessarily be treated the same, but on average, males are just as likely to get an engineering position at Amazon as females are. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay. Is it possible for both of those to exist simultaneously, that you're fair at the individual level and you're fair at the group level?
It's possible, but it requires some constraints or some assumptions. So, but it's not, it's these two actually, in most of the time, I would say, they do not, you know, consistent with each other. So that means, say, achieving individual fairness may not, you know, lead to achieving group fairness only under certain scenarios that these two are, you know, would be consistent with each other. That means you can achieve both. For example, and also when it comes to individual fairness and or group fairness, there are also different fairness criteria there. So for example, there are demographic parity, equalized odds, equal opportunity. So there are different group level fairness as well. And for individual fairness, I can also list a list of individual fairness, say causality related, or it's just avoid proxy discrimination, or, you know, within each category, there are also different fairness criteria there. So, in terms of, you know, which fairness criteria you are talking about, is another complex issue here.
So you mentioned, I think, about half a dozen different fairness criterias. Now, before we started this episode, I actually looked up what does fair mean in the dictionary, because it's just it's a word that we all have a sense of what fair is in the sense of our own selves, but I just wanted to know, what does fair actually mean? And according to the dictionary I looked up, fair means unbiased. And I think that creates another set of problems, because one of the things I learned when I was studying machine learning is that every machine learning model has to have bias in it, because otherwise it would be just selecting people at random, which doesn't work. So you have to have, you know, in our job search model, for example, we want the model to be biased in favor of people who are actually good at doing their jobs. We just don't want it to be biased based on protected attributes of people. So obviously in the machine learning sense, we can't have fair means completely unbiased, otherwise we'd get useless models. So can you give me one or two examples of some of these fairness criteria that you just mentioned?
Absolutely. I think this is a very good question, a very important one. I would say that the fairness concept, as you said, it's really differ, you know, if you're talking about different situations. I'll give you two simple examples, because I have been working on insurance pricing for so long. I just, you know, just too easy for me to grab the insurance examples. Let's think of two examples. One is that, say, everyone purchased car insurance, right? Mm-hmm. And then you would have, you know, face two kinds of car insurance. One is compulsory car insurance that is regulated by the by each jurisdiction. You must purchase the third party compulsory insurance. Another one is a voluntary insurance that you can choose to purchase or not purchase, and you can choose comprehensive cover or some, you know, some other covers, right? So you can choose the coverage. So like these two type of car insurance, the fairness concepts are different. So for the compulsory third party insurance, for example, in ACT Australia, it's community rating. That means if you purchase the compulsory third party insurance from an insurer, they give you exactly the same price. They do not even think about your risk profile, your gender, your age, your car type, nothing. Everyone got the same price from the same insurer. That's based in ACT. And then in, say, New South Wales, it's highly regulated. It does not, it's, everyone maybe may get different prices, but insurers are highly regulated to use only specific rating factors in order to do the pricing for your compulsory car insurance. So this is compulsory one. But when it comes to voluntary car insurance, then there's much less regulation. That means the insurers can use a whole bunch of rating factors to do the pricing. And if, for example, in ACT, if you purchase the voluntary car insurance, then you need to submit, say, your age, gender, car type, where's the location of your car, where do you live, right? This sort of information should be provided, because they are the rating factor that the insurers use to price your car insurance. So as you can see, these two very simple examples already show you the different notion of fairness, why we are having like these different regulations. And if I look, you know, more specifically into these two examples, I can say that in the first example, the compulsory third-party insurance in ACT community rating, I can classify it into group fairness because I can prove that it's actually satisfy the demographic parity, the group fairness. But for the voluntary one, I would tend to classify it into individual fairness because they are using individual rating factors and people are getting different prices subject to their risk profiles. So the reason of the difference is that these two line of business or these two different products are serving for different needs of the society. For the compulsory third party, we can treat that as a social safety net because everybody have to have access to compulsory car insurance as a protection to them. Yeah, because the government or the society want to give everybody such a protection. So then we tend to allow for cross subsidy, right? And then, so we tend to give everyone the same price so that everyone can have access to the product and also get the protection. But for voluntary, then it's more for economic purposes. So we allow for the insurers to classify their policyholders, subject to the different risk profiles. This is more of a consideration of economic efficiency because we want, because if you allow for this, then it could potentially avoid adverse selection, moral hazard, this sort of economic related issues. It would, you know, help with the economy and also, you know, achieve more economic efficiency. So this is because of the different considerations. And it's actually acceptable to the society as well. So, and also another example is say health insurance in Australia is also community rating because it's more serve as a social safety net or social good. We can treat that as a social good. But for some insurance, it's more an economic product or economic good. So somewhere in between, right? So these different considerations lead to the different notion of fairness.
And I assume that which definition you choose is going to depend on what's considered to be socially acceptable in that particular set of circumstances.
Yes.
So what I'm thinking, you know, I was trying to translate your example into a non-insurance example. If we just think about going down the supermarket, if you go down the supermarket and buy a can of Coke, every single person who buys that can of Coke will be charged exactly the same amount. And we would consider it to be unfair if we charged one group of people more for the can of Coke than another group of people in that same supermarket. But if you go to the movies, they have all different ticket prices. You know, they have the senior's price, the child's price, the adult's price, the student's price, all of those. So there's discrimination going on there. We're discriminating based on which group of people you belong to, but we consider it to be fair to charge some groups more than others because some are considered to be more able to afford it. And in that set of circumstances, society has clearly deemed it fair to charge adults more than children, for example.
Yeah. Actually, in the economics, there are three types of price discrimination. They're first degree, second degree, and third degree. Actually, you know, charging a different price to different consumer groups belong to the third degree price discrimination.
This is actually reminding me of a cartoon that I saw, which I think did the rounds of the internet a while ago. And it's an illustration of equity versus equality. Have you seen it? It's the one with the three children?
No.
Okay, so it's got three children and they're each of different heights and they're trying to watch a baseball game over a fence and only the tallest child is tall enough to actually see over the fence without any assistance. And one of the panels in the cartoon is labelled equality. And in that panel, all of the children are given a single box to stand on. So that would be treating all three children equally. But in that scenario, the tallest child, well, they could see over the fence already without the box. The middle child can now see over the fence, but the smallest child still can't see over the fence. And then in the second panel, you've got equity. And in that case, the shortest child is given two boxes, the middle child's given one box, and the tallest child doesn't need a box. And then all of the three children can see over the fence. And I think what that's trying to illustrate is you can either treat everyone equally, but that doesn't necessarily lead to an equal outcome, or you can try and aim for an equal outcome, which might not necessarily be the result of equal inputs. And so that would be two different versions of fairness. And each of those scenarios could be considered fair or unfair, depending on the way you look at it. So I would imagine that that's the sort of thing that people are looking at when they're evaluating the fairness of various pricing models and predictive models.
Yeah, absolutely. Right? Yeah, absolutely. Like equal, I think equity is sort of related to equal treatment, and then equality related to say equal outcome, right? And then actually in the United States, there are two similar legal concepts. One is called disparate treatment. The other is called disparate impact. So disparate treatment is sort of related to like fairness through unawareness. For example, if you do not use that, and then you do not use the protective attributes, for example, they sort of believe that you are treating everyone, you know, it's like achieve the disparate, there's no disparate treatment. But there could still lead to disparate, you know, outcome or disparate impact on the outcome. So and then people would say maybe some more fairness criteria or more mitigation efforts should be made in order to achieve, you know, equality in the end. And again, it would link to the different, you know, specific application or specific scenario and see what is more acceptable to the society.
So which fairness criteria are most commonly used in practice?
In practice, it also depends on which line of business, but I would say fairness through unawareness is most commonly used. It's basically I do not collect any protected attributes. And then, but people currently, I think most people are well understood that it cannot achieve like achieve equal outcome, for example, at least subject to some fairness criteria. Yeah.
So you need to have, if you want to achieve equal outcomes, then you need to be aware of the fact that people are starting from different starting points and make concessions for people who are starting behind, like the short kid, and assist them so that you can get those equal outcomes.
Yeah. I think that's more like, for some line of business, especially, I think this is especially related to the line of business that we tend to treat them as social good. Especially for those lines that we treat them as social good, then we should aim for like, you know, equal outcome, right? You know, in addition to, you know, not equal treatment, but more equal outcome. Another thing is that currently people are talking about, say, climate related, you know, impacts on people with, you know, living in different areas. That's also sort of related examples that, you know, people could think about what's the real outcome that we want to achieve.
So can you give me an example of those climate-related examples?
Yeah, I think recently there's the government have a reinsurance, cyclone reinsurance pool. And also recently there are some, you know, reports, I think it's from Finity Consulting on the, you know, the socioeconomic, you know, socioeconomic differences related to the home insurance. I think that's, I mean, for example, people living in the areas that's that's more vulnerable related to climate change or, you know, the say the climate related disasters, then they are facing a higher premiums, right? And then some, for some areas, could even do not have access to insurance. And then what should we do, right? And then what is what's the fairness should be applied in these kinds of scenarios? I think it's a really interesting problem.
And I think that came up with the Lismore floods in Australia last year or at the start of this year, where there were some people who were uninsured because even before the floods occurred, the insurance premiums were tens of thousands of dollars per year.
Yeah.
And, you know, is it fair for them to have to pay higher premiums, or is it fair for them to be cross-subsidized by people who are in safer, drier areas?
Yeah, that's an interesting problem to think about. Actually, one of my research recently is just looking at the impact of the different fairness criteria from the economic perspective. So what's the impact on both consumer welfare and the firm's profits if we apply different fairness criteria? So that could be you know, an interesting thing that for the regulators or the, you know, the general society to think about.
And it's interesting because we know from different areas where they have tried to make concessions to adjust for historic discrimination against particular groups. You know, sometimes they're treated fair. No one seems to have any problems with them. Like no one has an issue with wheelchair access to buildings. Whereas other times, like gender quotas end up with all sorts of debate. Some people are in favour of them, some people are against them. I'm not opening that can of worms here.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So what we've said here is that it's possible for an organisation to end up accidentally discriminating against someone or without intending to do it, that the way people try and deal with fairness is by trying to be blind to particular protected attributes. But even doing that, they can end up accidentally discriminating due to proxies. So these well-meaning organisations could inadvertently end up breaching anti-discrimination laws that exist in particular jurisdictions. Has there ever been a case where an organisation has been prosecuted for breaching anti-discrimination laws when they were deliberately taking action to try and avoid discrimination?
I think they are currently, this is still an emerging area, and the regulators are also trying to provide more clear guidance what the firm should do. So I think as far as I know, in Australia, there's it's basically very, very limited examples in terms of the indirect discrimination related, breaching the laws. But for the United States, I think it's always under a heated debate. I think the case laws are also they are still very limited in terms of indirect discrimination, because I'm mainly focusing on the insurance lines. So I'm saying that for the insurance related indirect discrimination cases, there's very limited that currently we could find, but it's definitely under heat discussions. And then the regulators are trying to provide more clear guidance in terms of what should be done and what should not be done. Yeah.
I think one of the interesting things in the United States is they don't just have the laws protecting people who have protected attributes. In insurance, they also have those laws preventing price optimization in some states, which is basically discrimination against people based on non-protected attributes. For example, this person's in a wealthier area than this other person, so let's charge the richer person more.
Yes. I think you raised a very interesting example here. So usually, generally speaking, protected attributes are, you know, for every large business, they have to be very careful with, you know, either direct or indirect discriminating against those protected attributes. But for insurance, it's a little bit different where there are other considerations, especially if you use non-risk-based pricing factors. Price optimization is something I think is commonly used in some markets, including Australia. I think Europe is also using price optimization a lot. But US is, I think, starting from 2015, up to now, it's around 20 states already banned price optimization in the United States for the insurance pricing and underwriting. The main reason is that they believe the price optimization or those non-risk-based attributes is not suitable to be used for insurance purposes. For example, people who are more willing to change their insurers or more willing to shop around get lower prices. Mm-hmm. And the more loyal customers get higher prices. And in the UK, historically, there's a price walking. So the longer you stay with the insurer, the higher prices you get. So it's like every year there's a price walking. And starting from earlier this year, UK banned price walking. So this is in similar, I think the idea is similar to the price optimization ban in the United States, which is all banning the non-risk based factors. It's also something that it's not every jurisdiction are doing this, but it's definitely leads to discussions in different markets, including Australia here as well. Yeah.
Do you think that in Australia we'll one day have laws preventing price optimization?
I don't know. Yeah, it's very difficult to predict, but it's definitely something that people could think about. Actually, in my current research, I'm trying to looking at the impact of this bans. So what's the real welfare cost of these different regulations? I think I can provide you with the link of the paper after this interview. So it's actually, I mean, for lots of the regulations, it's a fairness loss rather than fairness gain. I mean, based on my simple model. So it's, I mean, of course, when regulators having those, you know, those the regulation into considerations, they are usually not just from the economic perspective, from the welfare gain or welfare loss. Sometimes they think more of like the vulnerable groups or people with low socioeconomic status. So that's another perspective that's why there are this type of regulations and also say accessibility to insurance. So, I mean, I think what I want to say is that more research is needed in this area to understanding the real impact of each of these regulations, say either price walking ban or price optimization ban, so that everybody is more informed what will happen if we have this ban, and what are the options to protect the consumers, while at the same time, the firms are also, you know, gaining profit and also, you know, not highly impact on the sustainability. Yeah.
So you mentioned before fairness losses and fairness gains. So what you're saying is that in some circumstances, by banning discriminatory actions, either discriminatory based on protected attributes or on non-protected attributes, that can actually make everyone worse off.
That can, yes. It depends on which perspective are you looking at, right?
Yeah.
But from the economic welfare perspective, it can leave everyone worse off. It's possible under certain scenarios.
Very interesting. What can you give me an example of one of the scenarios where it does leave everyone worse off?
I think it's probably easier if we, you know, when the final paper is out, where we have more rigorous studies so that you also understand the assumptions.
Okay.
Of all these circumstances. But I can clearly see that for many of the combinations, for example, if there are costs, there's regulations banning the cost say when insurers do cost modeling, the technical prices, if there are regulations there at a group, we mainly focus on the group level fairness there. And or if there are regulations on price optimization on the final prices, or regulations on achieving demographic parity, the group level fairness on the final prices, or if there's a combination of both banning the cost, estimating the cost and estimating the prices. So we look at all sorts of regulations, and we employed a simple economic model to understand the welfare impact on both consumers and firms. And we can see that lots of this combination leads to worse off outcomes.
That's very interesting. Yeah. If you send through the link, I'll include that in the show notes, because I'm sure a lot of people will be interested in reading that.
Yeah, but I have to, and that, again, I wanna you know, remind everyone that that is from the economic welfare perspective. So because we do not have the data sets to understand the profiles linked to the consumer's vulnerability or socioeconomic status, so we basically do not understand. Maybe there will be welfare gain on the vulnerable people from this perspective. It's worse well, it's better off, but from the purely the data that we have access to, and from purely the economic welfare perspective, it could lead to worse off scenarios. Yeah.
That's very interesting. So a lot of the points we've raised in this discussion, I can see potentially putting organizations off using machine learning models, or if they're already using them, making them think twice about using them. Because basically what we've told people is that even if they're trying very hard not to, they can end up discriminating against people.
Yeah.
And even though this might not cause issues with anti-discrimination laws now, because it sounds like they don't fully cater to AI and machine learning just yet, you know, in the future, this could lead to them breaching some future law. What would you say to an organisation that was thinking of going down the path to machine learning to try and reassure them that, you know, there are benefits that outweigh these risks of discriminatory activity?
Yeah, I think that's a very important question that I believe every organization should carefully think about. For example, if you are considering whether to use some additional data sets, or if you want to implement a black box of very complex machine learning models, think about the risks versus the return of it. And also, I think it's very important to understand the regulations in the jurisdiction that you have business. For example, if it's an international firm, have business in different jurisdictions, then even just in Australia, if you have business in different states, I mean, the protected attributes you are facing can be slightly different. So, I mean, I think that's something that the organization have to be aware of. Another thing I want to remind is that, as you said, mitigating direct discrimination does not necessarily mean mitigating indirect discrimination. So also organizations should think about if there are, you know, strong proxies there and how to mitigate indirect discrimination. So although this is still a little bit vague area in terms of regulation guidance, but I think the regulators are making efforts in providing more guidance here. So I think keep up to date to the latest information in terms of what can be done and what cannot be done. And the final advice I want to give is that actually sometimes people tend to look, you know, too much on the marginal gain in terms of prediction accuracy, but tend to forget about what's the real return on your company. For example, if I employ a machine learning black box model, I probably improve my prediction accuracy by, say, 5%. And then that means lots of efforts, and it's complex, you lose the transparency. And then when you look at the real impact on the firm, say the profit, or what's the 5% prediction accuracy really means, for your for the profits of the firms, or the value of the firms, or the volume of the products that you could have, then it could be minimum or even, you know, neglectable. So I think it's important to understand the real value of either getting a big data set or using a more complex algorithm. And then also think about what you lost. You lost the transparency, or you lost the interpretability, and then something else. So I'm not against black box models, but I just thought it had to be all taken into consideration.
And if using a black box model leads to either a massive fine or to a massive scandal that leads to a loss of business, then any benefits you gained from that black box model are going to be eliminated.
Yeah. So I think that's something I think academics should work together with industries to make those, so to help them understand better the real benefits of the different more fancy models, and also try to make the models more interpretable, at the same time give you more prediction accuracy. So I think there's lots of, you know, space or gaps that could be filled in the future. I think lots of research needs to be done.
So the key points I'm getting here that businesses should take away are, don't be scared of using machine learning models. However, if you're going to go down that path, go in with your eyes open.
Yeah.
So consider different models, not just about which model gives you the most accuracy, but which model gives you the best results.
Yeah.
Which is a trade-off between accuracy and transparency.
Yeah, and also the regulation risk, right? The discrimination risk, fairness risk, all this into consideration.
Yeah, and generally try and be a good corporate citizen.
Yeah.
So if you're taking steps to demonstrate that you're actively trying to avoid being discriminatory, then I would imagine that even if something went wrong, if you could say, well, we've deliberately not collected these protected attributes, and we have done all these tests to ensure we're being fair at the individual or group level, then you could make a pretty fair case if you ever did have something go wrong.
Yes, actually in my class, so I teach data analytics at UNSW. In my class, in my first class, I always tell students, have technology in hand, humanity in mind. So you have to have both.
Yeah. And that way you don't end up with a situation like Terminator where you end up with us versus the machines.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so we're getting pretty close to the end. But I have a few final questions for you. Is there anything on your radar in the AI data and analytics space that you think is going to become important in the next 3 to 5 years?
Yeah, I think still ethical and responsible use of AI and the big data is still something that I believe will attract more and more attention, and miss lots of work to be done in this area. So I think this is definitely a trend in the next few years. Another thing is related to this, climate change towards net zero, right? So some big problems that the whole society or the whole world trying to resolve is also linked to the ethical and the responsible use of AI. And also say that when I say ethical, it's actually includes, but not limited to discrimination or fairness related thing. It's also about transparency, accountability, interpretability, for example. So it's a whole package of ethical use of AI and big data. And in Australia, there's a voluntary ethical AI framework that organization could refer to. And they also provide some examples, case studies about some other, you know, pioneers who how they adopted the ethical AI framework in their business.
That framework sounds like it could be of great use to our listeners. Do you have a link that you could send me for that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. If you send me that, I'll include that in the show notes.
Yeah.
And what final advice would you give to organisations looking to maximise the value of their data through either fairness and anti-discrimination or through anything else?
Yeah, my final advice is probably, I think it's still like have a good understanding of your data, your model, and ask yourself whether you really need that. What's the real impact on your consumers and on your firms? And also take all those regulation into consideration, potential regulation risk, and also have a good understanding of the requirements of anti-discrimination regulations and laws in the specific jurisdictions.
So be a good person and act responsibly, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, this has been great having you here, Faye. For listeners who want to learn more about you or get in contact, is there some way in which they can do that?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm very happy and open to be connected. So I can send you my LinkedIn profile, and also I have a public profile on USW website. I'm happy to be connected via LinkedIn or my email address.
And I'll put those in the show notes for anyone listening.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thank you so much, Genevieve. I really enjoyed our conversation today, and I'm sure this is a great topic, and more conversations and discussions is also going on in our society. Yeah,
I can only see this getting bigger in the future.
Yeah.
And for those in the audience, thank you for listening to me today. I'm Dr. Genevieve Hayes, and this has been Value Driven Data Science, brought to you by Genevieve Hayes Consulting.